Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This is your host, Dan Nexon. In this episode, I interview Alistair Reynolds, a multiple award-winning and nominated author. He's probably best known for his Revelation Space series, which begins with Revelation Space. He is going to be talking about his new book, Blue Remembered Earth, which has been generating a lot of buzz and was even the subject of a short discussion on our first podcast with Ken McLeod. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I am talking to Alistair Reynolds. Alistair, are you there?
I am indeed, Dan.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's a great pleasure.
I thought that we would start out, as I always do, with your perhaps telling our readers a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm a 46-year-old science fiction writer living in Wales. I was born in Wales originally in 1966. My family, I have sort of strong Welsh roots, but my family moved down to Cornwall in England when I was fairly small. So I spent my formative years in that part of the world. And then we moved back to Wales probably when I was about eight years old. I never have had a strong Welsh accent, which is something that always throws people when they meet me. But that's largely because my formative years were spent in England. And then as soon as I was old enough, I left Wales. I went off and got an education. And I was pretty clear in my mind from, I think, about the age of 14 that I wanted to study astronomy or science or some area of science. And that's what I ended up doing. And I went away to Newcastle and I got a degree in physics. And that led on to a doctorate in astronomy, which I did in Scotland. And then I ended up working abroad. But across that whole period, I'd also been basically getting more and more into science fiction and starting to write it. From a very early age, I was always making up stories. One of my very earliest memories, actually, is going to being taken to the cinema when we lived in Cornwall. And my father took me to see a double bill of two James Bond films. It was From Russia with Love and then Goldfinger. And I remember sitting through From Russia with Love, probably about the age of six, just being completely bored out of my mind by this film because there was nothing in it particularly to engage the imagination of a six-year-old. But then Goldfinger came on, and I thought it was the most amazing, awesome thing I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, there were cars with gadgets coming out of the wheels. There were lasers. It was amazing. And I came home from that with my mind rewired, I think. And I remember I went into school the day after and started drawing these illustrations and stories all sort of related to what I remembered from Goldfinger. And years later, I saw From Russia with Love, and it's clearly the superior film, but it doesn't really work on that level when you're 6 years old. So I started writing stories from a very early age, and then I suppose started writing longer and longer stories, and I got a measure of encouragement from teachers. They would always sort of pat me on the back and say, "That's a very nice story, Alistair." So I saw no incentive to stop writing. And I just kept on writing and writing through my, writing to my teens and just writing longer and longer things. And then I wrote a couple of novels when I was a teenager. And so this was all going on in the background, as it were, when I was also studying and working towards getting an education. But I always had it in mind that I would become a published science fiction writer at some point. I had no plans beyond that. I certainly didn't envisage a career. I had no clear idea that there was such a thing as a career in science fiction. I just wanted to write science fiction and get it out there. And that's basically what happened. It took a long time, but I eventually broke into magazine publishing. In the late 80s, I started selling stories to the British science fiction magazine Interzone. I was working in Scotland at the time, just starting my PhD. And in sort of spare hours here and there, often lunchtimes, I would either sit and hammer away at a typewriter, or I would go and find a word processor or a computer that someone wasn't using, and I would try and sort of write a bit of science fiction on it. And that's basically how it started, and I just kept on doing that. One sale led to another, and then there were the usual setbacks and periods where you don't feel like you're getting anywhere. But I just kept on and eventually wrote a novel. And again, after a period of time, I was able to sell that. And everything has sort of followed from that, really. I'm now writing full-time, which, again, is something I never expected to happen. But I'm in a very fortunate position to be doing that now and enjoying it.
So one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is how your background as a scientist shapes your speculative fiction. I mean, one of the things that I see and hear reading about and talking to science fiction authors is the diversity of trajectories into the genre now, right? You have people who come at it from a literary tradition or a MFA tradition. You have people who are primarily fans. And then you have people like yourselves who have a very strong scientific background. And how has that informed the way that you approach the genre?
It's a very deep question, and it's one that I'm always trying to take a step back, if you will, and look at my own fiction and sort of try and gauge to what extent it's shaped and influenced by my background as a scientist. But I really can't say, because my interest in science and science fiction, they really do go right back into my childhood, and it's very hard for me to sort of disentangle those two threads and say which one came first. You know, a lot of the science fiction that really pushed the right buttons for me when I was growing up was kind of at the sort of harder edge of it, I suppose. Science fiction writers like Asimov and Clarke, who were sort of at least scientifically schooled in science and had a sort of respect for the science. And I kind of sort of steeped myself in that stuff as I was growing up. I really struggle with it, because when I was a working scientist, particularly in the last sort of 10 years of my career, I was working at the European Space Agency in Holland. And I did a lot of different jobs. I worked on a lot of different projects, and most of them were very, very interesting in the sense that they were challenging little sort of problems or projects that I was engaged with that were intellectually stimulating. But almost none of them were anything that in your right mind, you would never think of them as something that would make good fiction. You know, I was involved in a project for many years that had to do with making a camera work, basically. I was part of a team that was involved in the development of a prototype optical camera, which would ultimately it might have flown in space, but in the sort of near term, it was going to be plugged into the back of ground-based telescopes, and they were going to do science with this. And I went around with the team involved in this camera. We went to telescopes in the Canary Islands, did observations on it, and I was part of the team kind of trying to get some real science out of this thing. So I wrote the software that took the raw data in a very sort of obscure format and tried to sort of massage it in a way that you actually got some science out the end. And it was really interesting, because you were dealing with questions of microsecond time tagging accuracy on photons and energy calibration and spatial calibration, but all of it really boring to anyone who wasn't sort of involved in that area of astrophysics. And there was never a point where I was working on an instrument where I thought, oh, this would be a good idea for a science fiction story. And all the ideas that I think I made the best use of as a writer were things that had caught my eye in, I would say, the popular press, if you like. I might be reading New Scientist, and I sort of stumble on an idea or a story that seems to sort of spark a little imaginative, set off an imaginative spark, actually. And that would then lead me down a process where I might end up with a story. But it would never be something that came from my work as such. I suppose the only thing that I took away from science that might sort of lend some color to my fiction would be, one, an understanding of how science actually works on a day-to-day level, because if you're working in laboratories, you see science being done all the time. You understand that it's, you know, a very, very human enterprise. Scientists are people. They make mistakes. They just get on with it. They're not sort of evil geniuses trying to take over the world. Most scientists are just worried about getting the next budget, the next grant, or getting the next job application sorted out. So that was all useful, and I got an insight into sort of office politics and how something like a large space agency functions. But all of that was kind of secondary to the actual the scientific content itself. And to this day, I still get my best ideas just from basically just keeping my eyes and ears open and being ready to let ideas land on me, and keeping up with the popular press. So I read New Scientist every week. I read Scientific American. I watch scientific documentaries on television, and you just let it all soak down into you. And over time, you hope that there are going to be these sort of weird moments where you sort of link things together in a way that hopefully no one has done before. And someone said recently, the way to write science fiction is to try and think of the one story in the world that only you could write. And when something like that happens, where you sort of see a connection between two areas, you think, I'm the only person who could ever have seen that. That's a magic moment, and it's one of the things that gets me through the long hours of writing is those little flashes where you see a connection between things.
It's funny, as you're talking, I can think about a lot of ways in which you say that the unique perspective that you describe, or at least the special perspective you describe, informs specific events or moments in Blue Remembered Earth. But before we get into that book, I was hoping you might talk a bit about the arc of your writing and your corpus of work, because you obviously have an extensive corpus of work, as you've alluded to, a number of very successful and very acclaimed novels under your belt already before this new trilogy that's kicked off with Blue Remembered Earth.
Well, I think sometimes people are a bit surprised when they find out I've been writing for as long as I have, because I've been publishing, I mean, science fiction I've been paid for now for 23 years, I think. I got my first check in 1989. Which was an amazingly long time ago. And I've been basically just writing steadily ever since. And I was working on the sort of early drafts of Revelation Space, actually as far back as the 80s. And then, I sort of put it aside and then came back to it in the early 90s. I think in 1992 I started working seriously on the book that would become Revelation Space. And I finished it in 94, again put it aside and came back to it a couple of years later. I had a period of unemployment, which was pretty miserable at the time, but it was actually really useful because it gave me the chance to actually dust that novel off, knock it into some kind of shape and actually submit it. And I've just been writing steadily ever since. So I have produced quite a large body of work. I'm always trying to find that sweet spot between being prolific and being over-prolific. I mean, I think you can overproduce as much as you can underproduce. I mean, as someone who consumes art and literature and music, I'm often drawn to artists who are prolific. I mean, I particularly admire Neil Young, who's just had this amazing, or sustained this amazing output of work over almost 50 years. And I will readily accept that not everything that Neil Young puts out is perfectly formed or perfectly polished. But I enjoy the fact that there's always a new Neil Young album imminent. But at the same time, I also like Bruce Springsteen, who's not sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum. He often takes an enormously long time between releases. So I'm always trying to balance that. But I am basically prolific. I've written more or less a novel a year since 2000, and I've tried. For me, writing short fiction was not a stepping stone into getting a book deal. It's a thing unto its own right that I genuinely enjoy, and I'm always a little bit disappointed at the end of the year if I haven't written all that much short fiction. So I always try and carve out a bit of time to write some short stories, and if people offer me the opportunity to write a short story, I'll jump on it. And I can often, I mean, if you talk about an arc and I look over my career, there's no real long-term planning going on there. It's just, I never really think more than one book ahead. But over time, you have these little, impulses that you think, well, I actually wouldn't mind going off in that direction maybe at some point. And then what I will often do is maybe just try a short story that kind of sort of nudges things slightly in a different direction, see how I get on with that. And then if that feels like a successful experiment, then I will follow it maybe a year or two later with a novel. And I did that with, long before I wrote House of Suns, I'd written a relatively long piece called Thousandth Night, which hasn't been particularly well. It's been a little bit difficult to get hold of, that story, but I wrote it and I was pleased with it, and it felt at the time like I was pushing in a slightly different direction. It was consciously slightly more optimistic in tone. It was definitely brighter. It was more sort of far future orientated than anything I'd done before, and I felt, well, that's a direction I want to push down in a book or two. Once I get whatever commitments I had at the time out of the way. So that's what I did. In a few years, I came back to that story. And in fact, little random events can sort of push you in a different direction. I had an email from a fan who said, have you ever thought about going back to that universe and making a novel of it? I thought, yeah, that's a damn good idea. And in fact, I did enjoy writing that story. So there you go, I'll write a novel in that universe. And that became House of Suns. And that, in turn, I suppose, playing around with that book, which was optimistic in tone but very far future, started me thinking about something that's much more closer to home, much more near future in its setting, but which also has something of the same, I suppose, exuberance to it, and that I suppose ultimately became Blue Remembered Earth. But as I say, there is no real long-term plan. I mean, at the moment, I know that the next book is the sequel to Blue Remembered Earth, and the one after that will be the sequel to the sequel. But that's about as long-term as it gets in terms of my planning. I certainly don't I don't have some elaborate arc of my career sort of mapped out. I just basically go where the wind blows. And I mean, the book I'm writing at the moment is probably a little bit darker than Blue Remembered Earth, but that, again, I didn't I wasn't thinking I must write a dystopian sort of novel at some point. Yeah, so I just sort of basically follow my nose, and I don't sort of sweat these things too much. I just sort of go where it feels most interesting at the time. And often I often say this, actually, that the book that I'm working on is as much a reaction to the last book as anything else. It's often like, well, I've done this, I want to do something really, really different for the next book. I mean, particularly with Terminal World, which was the book before last, I'd written, I think, three preceding books before that were all essentially space operas of one color or another, and they all had lots of spaceships in them and different planets, and I thought, well, I really want to get away from that for a book. I want to do a story which is set entirely on one planet where there's lots of scenery and no spaceships. So that was Blue Remembered Earth, a sort of a conscious reaction to what I'd been writing before. So it's often as trivial as that, simply, well, I've done this, now I want to do something different.
So what are the basics that readers should know, or interested readers should know, about Blue Remembered Earth?
Well, I hope that it feels like a departure for me in some respects. I felt that I was almost trying to press a sort of big reset button on my career when I started writing that book, and that I suppose I've become uncomfortable. I mean, this goes back a long, long time. It goes back as far as Century Rain, in fact, where I felt that the incorporation of thriller elements, action adventure storylines, was not something I wanted to do for the rest of my career. I mean, it can be enormously fun, and I would never forsake that and say I'm never going to write a story where you have sort of people shooting at each other again. But I definitely wanted to get away from that at some point. And I mean, there were three or four things that came together. One was a sense that a certain type of science fiction that I had enjoyed a lot when I was growing up, sort of typified by, say, the novels of Clarke, the sort of mid-period novels of R.C. Clarke, where things are very, very exciting. I mean, you have a book like Rendezvous-Rama, which I remember just being absolutely mesmerized by when I was reading it as a kid. But there are no overt thriller elements in the story. It's essentially a novel about the methodical exploration of the unknown. And I thought, well, that's something that it can be, if it's done well, it can be a really effective motor for the story. It can be as compelling a read as any sort of murder mystery or suspense plot, if it's done well. And that's the catch. You have to do it well. How well I did it in Blue Remembered Earth, I don't know. And I'm still sort of trying to sort of piece that one together. But I wanted to get away from the a melodramatic plot structure. I also wanted to avoid I particularly wanted to get away from sort of large-scale violence. I wanted to write a future in which there were not endless wars and militarism and things blowing up. And, you know, things do blow up in the book, but I think it's at a much sort of quieter level than anything I've done before. So I felt that it was a change of direction for me, but I hope that the things that people like in my fiction, they'll sort of still find those things there. I mean, I was sort of as excited by it when I was writing it as I had been by anything else. But it did feel, I hesitate to say the word adult, but it felt like a slightly more adult novel than something like Revelation Space, which is, at times, the action in Revelation Space is quite cartoonish. And that was perhaps the intention at the time, but I certainly felt like I wanted to get away from that for a book or two. And the other sort of things that fed into Blue Remembered Earth were sort of time, and it was simply the right time to start a book like that. I had been in America in 2008 and had a really good opportunity to visit the Kennedy Space Center, I went back a couple of times after that, and I was lucky enough to see two space shuttle launches really near the end of the space shuttle program. And I've always been a fan of space exploration anyway, that's sort of obvious. But this definitely rekindled that basic delight in space exploration and a real sense of achievement. I mean, in 2009, it was the anniversary of the Apollo landings. I went back and I read a few books about the program and really got a deeper appreciation for what an amazing technological achievement that was in terms of the complexity of the program, the risks, the astonishing management of thousands of different people all sort of pushing in the same direction. And right at the top of that pyramid, you've got, you know, three incredibly brave astronauts on top of a rocket. And I just came away from that with a real renewed sense of enthusiasm and awe, in fact, for the idea of space travel. And I thought, well, it's not that I've not seen that in science fiction lately, but I felt it certainly had been absent from my science fiction, and I wanted to get that back into it. And it seemed that the sort of obvious way to do it seemed to be to bring the scope of the novel closer to home in terms of the timeline, and to write about real space exploration as it might happen, not as it might happen if we invent the warp drive, but as it might happen given what we know we can do now in terms of reasonable extrapolation of technologies. So that was in the mix. And the other thing, which I've spoken of at length, is that I was, and still am in fact, a big fan of African music. And I've been listening to a lot of it over a short period of time. And a number of, I saw there were sort of moments where it began to dawn on me that I wouldn't mind developing the idea of a future in which Africa was the sort of main technological power. I certainly wanted to give these books a different angle. I wanted them something in them that would put them slightly outside of the established canon of SF novels about space exploration, if you like. And I was certainly receptive to the idea that Africa might be the global powerhouse in 100 or 200 years. It seemed completely reasonable to me. I had not seen it done in science fiction before, so that was exciting. And it also gave me an excuse just to keep listening to all that great music. And that was a win-win situation for me. And I just kept listening to particularly West African music, although the bulk of the action in the book, that, I mean, by no means the whole novel is set on Earth anyway, and of the bits set on Earth, only a small number of them actually take place in Africa. But the sort of the characters in the book originate from East Africa. But it was the sort of the seed of the West African music that really made me think about going in that direction. And there was one particular piece of music, in fact, which I'm struggling to remember the name of now, but it was by a musician called Jeffrey Oriema, who I think I name check in the acknowledgements to the book. But it sort of planted a strong mental image in my mind of a woman on a spaceship, and she's somewhere in the universe. She's a long way from home, and she's African, and she's thinking back to this planet that she probably won't ever return to. And often novels can come from just a single image like that. You know, well, who is this character? What's she doing? Why is she on this ship? Why does she look so worried? What terrible decision is she about to make? And that sort of fed into it. And in fact, that character doesn't even appear in the first novel. She turns out to be a character in the second novel, which I didn't know at the time. But it's things like that, little random pushes and swerves that will send me in a particular direction.
You should probably walk our listeners a little bit more through the kind of basic setup and, you know, not spoiler range plot, but basic plot elements of Blue Remembered Earth. So it's set a few hundred years in the future. Is that correct? You can.
Yes, it's set. Well, I set it. It's often the case for me. I start writing things and I have sort of dates in mind, and then I usually end up bringing them a bit closer than they are in the first draft. And I think I started writing it, it was sort of 300 years in the future, but I get bogged down in things like what do the characters wear, it's always much easier for me if I can bring it a bit closer, because then you can sort of, well, maybe they still wear T-shirts and jeans, and I can just sort of get on with the story and not worry too much about things like that. So yeah, I set it 150 years in the future, which was as close as I felt I could reasonably set it, because I needed time for the backstory. I mean, it wasn't the problem was not that Africa becomes the dominant sort of technology, the dominant technological powerhouse at this time. I'm fully capable of believing that could happen in 100 years. But I did need time for my characters and their relatives to get up to a certain number of things before the sort of motor of the story could kick in. And I sort of sat down and worked it out and thought, well, yeah, the action can't really take place before around about the middle of the 22nd century. So that's when the book starts, 2162, I think. And so it starts, it's a kind of family drama, and that's a theme that continues through into the subsequent books, and that we're following members of one family, this African family, the Akinyi family, who are, at the start of Blue Remembered Earth, they're established as a very powerful, wealthy family with their fingers in lots of technological pies, particularly areas related to space exploration and space entrepreneurialism. So I was thinking, you know, sort of like Elon Musk or Bill Gates, say, in 150 years, except that it's an African family this time. And they have sort of controlling stakes in some of the key technologies for access to Earth orbit and travel around the solar system. So they've got lots of money. And all the sort of the key members of the family, all they really want to do is make more money by sort of mining more things in the solar system, planting more flags on things. But the two protagonists of the novel are two siblings of near equal age, Sunday and Jeffrey. And they've both basically turned their back on the family business to sort of degrees of disgust from the rest of the family. And Sunday, she's gone to live in this sort of quasi-anarchic commune on the moon, where they practice everyone else lives in this sort of society which is highly surveilled, where you can't really breathe without it being sort of picked up and becoming a matter of public record. So Sunday lives in this little enclave on the moon where they go exactly the opposite way, where they've sort of got rid of all that sort of surveillance sort of stuff. And she's an artist, she's a struggling artist. And her brother, who's remained behind in Africa, has turned his attention on to the study of elephants. And I sort of homed in pretty early on the idea that elephants were going to be a plot element. But they became progressively more important to the story as I got into the writing of the book. And what essentially happens is that Jeffrey and Sunday are dragged into a family conspiracy of which they want no part. But they eventually find themselves left with little choice but to investigate a mystery that's left behind by the death of their grandmother, who is this forbidding figure, Eunice Akinyi. She's the sort of the woman who created the family fortune. She's an early space explorer. She's born, according to the internal timeline of the book, she's born in 2030, so she's born very close to the present day. She's one of the first people to land on Mars, and she goes off and sort of plants flags all over the solar system, makes loads of money. Well, then something happens to her, and she enters becomes a recluse. She enters a period where she has no direct contact with the family or the rest of the human race. She basically just locks herself away in the space station for the rest of her life, and then she dies. And after her death, a loose end comes to light that sort of hints that she may have got up to something earlier in her life. It's not a matter of public record, and it's the siblings then, Sunday and Jeffrey, who get dragged into figuring out what exactly their grandmother had got up to. Why has she buried something on the moon? And this then leads on to something else. I mean, some people said it's a treasure hunt plot. It's like the Da Vinci Code. I suppose there are elements of truth to that. It seemed I wanted a storyline that would give me justification for having my characters travel around the solar system. And I also like the idea that although the society in which they live is relatively benign, it's relatively peaceful, there's no war, there's little violence, nonetheless, there are things left over floating around the solar system. And even on Earth, there are sort of nasty booby traps left over from less enlightened times that you have to sort of be on your guard about. And that seemed to me a way to get some real sort of peril into the story without necessarily violating the terms of my imagined universe. So it's on one level, it's still a bit of an action story, even though I said I was trying to get away from all that. But the action is quite dialed down, quite muted, and it's primarily a story about family responsibility, I think. And then I tried not to make anyone in it a cartoon villain. There are opposing figures in the family, but we find out that they're not. They're not completely evil-hearted capitalists. They do have some humanity in them. And various events ensue, and at the end of the book we have, I would say, a sort of springboard into the next novel, which then picks up the thread of the Akinyi family, but in fact from the point of view of the descendant of Sunday. So we're now following Sunday's daughter 200 years into her life. So it's quite a sort of leap forward then from the events of Blue Remembered Earth.
Now, you've already used this term a great deal to describe the novel, particularly in comparison to your earlier work, and it's one that I think is, if you read the critical reviews online and in magazines, it's the term that everybody uses, right, which is that this is an optimistic novel.
Yes.
You must be getting sick of hearing that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of set myself up for it, and I'm not really surprised, because if you look at, I mean, you don't have to be very optimistic in science fiction to look optimistic these days. I mean, if you look at the sort of, your typical science fiction novel or film for that matter, the sort of default, the mixing desk, everything's sort of pushed as far as dark as possible, isn't it? You know, everything's post-apocalyptic or post-climate crash or post peak oil. Everything's gone to hell in a handcart. And I want more from science fiction than one vision of the future. I'm not saying that I don't think that there are tough times ahead or that we should shirk these responsibilities. But when I was growing up, science fiction was not it was not one thing. It was a very sort of multicolored, multivalent thing that you could sort of pick and choose from. And if you felt like reading something that was a bit more upbeat, you could go and read that, or you could go and read something gloomy if that was where your sort of preferences were. But I think particularly with realistically toned science fiction set in the future, there is a real a real absence of, I mean, not even optimistic, but not even non-pessimistic science fiction, I think. And I was involved a few years ago, peripherally, in a debate within science fiction circles about optimism versus pessimism, utopianism versus dystopianism. And out of that, there came a number of initiatives. One of them was the Shine Anthology, which was a collection of stories edited by a friend of mine, I should say, full disclaimer, a Dutch friend of mine, Jetse de Vries. He wanted to basically push the needle a little bit in the other direction. So he set out a call for science fiction stories that would be set on Earth, set in the next 50 years, would not involve magic technology, there would not be a singularity, there would not be aliens coming down and offering us a solution to all our problems. He wanted sort of nuts and bolts, gritty, realistically toned science fiction stories that nonetheless offered, should we say, plausibly positive solutions to existing problems. And I wrote a story for Jetse that to some extent didn't quite engage with what he really wanted, but it got me thinking a lot about optimism within science fiction. And I was, again, to go back to Clark, I was thinking, well, you know, all those Clark novels of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were all futures that one would not mind living in at all. They were not grim, dark, dystopian futures by any means. There was no reason why one wouldn't choose to live in an Arthur C. Clarke future. And I grew up as a child of the 60s and 70s. I grew up with the television series of Gerry Anderson, who, maybe not as well known in the States, but I think some of his puppet shows did make it over to America. But he made an enormous string of children's television shows, mainly with puppets. It has to be said, you have to get the puppets out of the way first. But if you look at the sort of absolutely iconic Gerry Anderson series, was Thunderbirds, which was set in the 21st century, set in 2065. It was a future in which everything that was present in the 20th century was still there in the future, but it was a livable future. They had gadgets, they had technology, but they also had global government, they had world police, they had no sort of large-scale wars. And, you know, as a kid, I really, really wanted to live in the universe of Thunderbirds, and I still do to some extent. But science fiction has not been, I would say it's been consciously avoiding the depiction of reasonably optimistic futures for decades. And I wanted to do something that was a step in the other direction with Blue Remembered Earth. So I wanted to write a book that felt as if it was a plausible a plausible extrapolation from current trends. So I didn't want to ignore things like climate change. I didn't want to have a ridiculously sunny view of human nature. So there is still local warfare does happen in the universe of Blue Remote Earth, but it's policed and contained. And I just wanted to sort of get as much into the mix as possible, but at the same time not to sort of adopt this sort of pointlessly, not to make things dark simply for the sake of it, I suppose. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense, and I actually found I found Blue Remembered Earth, I guess, as you say, it's optimistic when compared to the glut of dystopian literature that's out there. But I found it more reflective than optimistic, and maybe I hope we can come back to that in a second. But while we are on the subject of this debate that's been going on in science fiction circles about whether or not science fiction ought to present futures that we want to live in, or futures that we can grasp for, right, ought to have a kind of utopian or at least non-dystopian vision. I was curious about your sense of why that is. I mean, the standard argument I think you see when this issue gets covered in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or in kind of when it breaks into extra genre discussions, is, oh, well, we live in an era where everybody's worried about climate change and terrorism and is uncertain and unhappy, and we just went through the Great Recession and all of that stuff, although this trend clearly predates the Great Recession. So there's a kind of a notion, oh, it's just the kind of the zeitgeist, and science fiction is responding to that zeitgeist. But it sounds to me like you're hinting that there's a different story out there that has to do with the internal dynamics of the genre itself and those who write in it.
It's a very, very complex picture at any one time. I mean, I just had a very interesting discussion yesterday on Twitter, in the 140-character discussion about this very issue. And someone had made the opinion that science fiction, as it stands today, as literary science fiction stands today, there's a sort of abdication of interest in the future. And it's not hard to see why that might be the case. I mean, if you look at your typical award shortlist in science fiction, or your typical anthology of the year's best science fiction, there's an awful lot of backward-looking science fiction. There's science fiction that shirks any engagement with the future. There are stories that are set in sort of gaslit Victorian alternate realities, that are stories that refer back to earlier science fiction stories in a very clever but at the same time facile way. And this, you can often read hundreds of stories, but you'll sit and read many stories in succession before you hit on one that actually seems to be engaged with the future. And people say, well, it is because we live in these treacherously uncertain times. It's impossible to get a handle on where things are going. And I'm a little bit skeptical about that, because people will say, well, we can't see our way through the next 20 years. Well, people couldn't see the way through the 1930s. That was an incredibly uncertain time, with the sort of specter of fascism looming, possibility of global war. People didn't know which way to turn then. And then people will say, well, we don't know. Technological change is happening so quickly now that science fiction is obsolete before you finish writing it. To which I say, well, if you look at the sort of pace of technological change between, say, 1850 and 1950, was astonishing. You have the first transatlantic telegraph cable by the middle of the 19th century, piece of global telecoms infrastructure already in place. Then you've got wireless and television in the early 20th century. You've got powered flight. And then you've got the development of nuclear power, the first glimmerings of the atomic age, even before World War II. So things have always been moving quickly. And there are sort of spurts and moments where it seems to be going quicker. It's a bit like punctuated equilibrium in evolution. You get these long periods where things don't move as quickly, and then there's little catch-up moments. But I don't think we're living in particularly privileged times in that sense. I think that from the perspective of 20 years from now, people will look back to 2012 and say, what were those guys worrying about? They didn't have a clue. Things weren't accelerating. Now, we people in 2032, we know what it's really like. But I'm a little bit skeptical about all those arguments, and I think why is there this lack of engagement with the future in science fiction? I don't know. I mean, for me, the only thing that really gets me out of bed in the morning and continues to excite me about science fiction is the fact that it is this fantastic tool for engaging with the future. It's a toolkit for thinking about the future. As I've said, if you look at the totality of science fiction, any given science fiction work is likely to be a very, very poor predictor of the future. I mean, science fiction is notoriously bad at predicting the future. But if you look at the totality of science fiction, the picture becomes a little bit less gloomy. And in fact, many things were anticipated in science fiction. People say, oh, well, science fiction didn't predict the internet or home computing, except for that one story by Murray Leinster in 1941 or whatever. Well, yeah, but that's the point. He got it right. One story got it right. So I tend to think of science fiction as a sort of huge collective thought experiment, probing not the future but the space of all possible futures, and for me that's what it's all about. I mean, I'm just constantly fascinated and absorbed by the idea of what the future holds for us, what lies in store, and I can't. I mean, having the sort of tools of science fiction at your disposal and not wanting to think seriously about the future seems to me a very odd thing. It's like being given an electric guitar and not wanting to make a noise on it.
It's interesting that you should point back to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, which is, of course, for many people who study international change or historical change or development of technology, et cetera, this is the period in which the great acceleration begins, right? The great divergence in which the Industrial Revolution sets Europe on its course to temporary global dominance, in which we start to get, a kind of futurist sensibility in culture and in what we have the origins of modern science fiction, all of that. So I'm with you when you say that the pace of change now is not necessarily any faster than the pace of change of that period. I mean, I think that the modern social sciences developed in the 19th century around this question, even prior to the late 19th century, of, why is it that the world we live in now looks really, really different than the world of our grandparents' generation, right? The passing of the Ancien Regime and what is this thing called modernity.
Yeah, but, I mean, you only have to look at the sort of things that H.G. Wells saw in his lifetime. I mean, Wells lived into the atomic age and the era of the jet airliner. And I think we often forget that. I mean, we see this sort of fustian Victorian figure, and we forget that he lived for another 50 years. I mean, he saw the post World War II era.
And I think that's one of the things that makes what you're doing. So if we sort of think about that, and we think about this comparison, well, the rate of change now may not be any more rapid than what people a century ago were experiencing. It may in some ways be less rapid for people living in the advanced industrialized world. We could debate that, right? It's all kind of experiential. And part of our sense of how fast it is a sense of how we narrate it, the way in which science fiction is then complicit in our understanding of our rate of change. But all that being said, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about Blue Remembered Earth is that you take us through, given the timeline and given the way that you seem to have plotted out your near future history. This is really, in some respects, a coda for this period that begins in the late 19th century, right? It's a coda for the effects on global climate of industrialization and the carbon era, right? It's a coda for the Great Divergence, because you've now taken us to the period of the Great Convergence, which is what we seem to be witnessing now, the catch-up of the developed world, right? Its rapid growth into being economic and technological powers. It's something which has not yet reached Africa the way it's reached Asia, but which I think, as you say, is plausible that it would reach Africa as well. And you sort of imagine, okay, well, what would life look like once we've come through that transformation and we're on the brink of the next?
Yes. I mean, when I started writing Blue Remembered Earth, I had, obviously, if you're going to set a novel in the middle of the 22nd century, you do have to come down on one side of the fence or the other in terms of your treatment of climate change. And My take on it, I mean, I'm broadly speaking a believer in climate change, but I follow the literature. I mean, I believe that the climate is changing. I also believe that the cause of the change is human industrial activity. But I follow the literature, and I try to have an open mind on it, and I'm prepared to accept that, you know, scientists are fallible at times, and groupthink is an issue. But if I had to put my money on it, I would say that we really are altering the climate. But I had to obviously decide to what level I was going to embed that into the imagined world of Blue Remember Day. So I basically took, there was an issue of New Scientist, where they presented various extrapolations of what the world would look like in 2100 under various climate change scenarios. So I basically said, well, to hell with it, I'll just take the worst possible scenario and, you know, project the maximum rate of sea level rise, the maximum the decline of forests in Central Africa, aridification, movement of people. I'll assume things go about as badly as we can imagine them, short of extinction. But I will posit that these characters live through these events over a time scale of decades, and they become normalized. Their world feels completely normal to them. It doesn't feel post-apocalyptic. It doesn't feel dystopian. And I think that's the way it would be. I mean, once you get through the sort of pain barrier of the sort of, you know, not to trivialize it, but the hardship and misery of relocation and the suffering that would come from scarcity of resources, things will normalize. Things always normalize. And I think someone who would be transplanted into 2012 from, say, 1862 would find many things about our present world would seem terribly dystopian to them. They would find them actually appalling and difficult to comprehend, and they would find it unbelievable that we accepted these things absolutely normal. But of course we do. We've lived through change over relatively long time scales, and we accept it as the way things are. We, you know, as for many decades, we accepted the fact that the world might end at any point due to global thermonuclear war, which is, when you think about it, is a completely ludicrous sort of way to live your life. But we accepted it. And now we accept that many of the things that we had depended on for years and years, like free availability of fossil fuels, these things may be coming to an end, and we have to adapt to new ways of continuing our civilization. But I'm enough of an optimist in that sense that I think that the world will come through these things. I'm a great believer in human ingenuity. I think pushed to the pinch, pushed to the limit, we can be creative and we can come up with solutions to things. I mean, just by gradually making things more efficient, we can do a great deal with what we already have on the Earth. We don't need any sort of magic new sort of technologies. We don't need fusion. I mean, it'd be great if fusion came along, but there's a tremendous amount we could do simply by being clever with the way that we utilize energy now. Hopefully I'm trying to sort of get at some of those issues, although sort of implicit in the background of Blue Remembered Earth. It's certainly not full of all that stuff in the foreground. And the other thing I wanted to... Sorry.
Yeah, no, go on. No.
Well, one of the things that I mean, this goes back to the comment you just made about possibly the rate of technological change is actually decelerating. And that's something that's been interesting me for a few years. And particularly with... I mean, I have sort of interest in aviation, and I was thinking, you know, like aviation technology changed dramatically throughout the 20th century. And you went from biplanes at the beginning of the century through to essentially the modern era of the jet airliner by sort of the early 1950s, and things have just slowed down. I mean, aircraft are more efficient now; they're safer, but they don't go any faster. They look more or less the same. And I found this this statement from Boeing somewhere on the internet, where they said that they're still making 747s, and they fully expect that people are still going to be flying 747s for decades to come. And nothing, well, you don't see that in science fiction very often. The idea that technologies just stick around, and I think that's something that science fiction often gets wrong. Despite abundant evidence to the contrary. I mean, the fact that, you know, television did not displace wireless, you know, the internet did not displace telephones or television. Things just stick around because they're good solutions. People still use bicycles. And I wanted to kind of hint at that in Blue Remembered Earth. So although the action is set 150 years in the future, there's lots of things that are still sort of familiar that I wanted to sort of put into the mix. A sense that in some respects the world looks more similar than you might expect given 150 years of progress. And again, that's something I think is has not been reflected in written science fiction, perhaps to the degree that it should. We're very fond of... I mean, science fiction writers love world-building. They love this idea of creating a completely imagined environment, a society from scratch. And I think they often, in that process, they often forget that you've got to leave room for the bits that will stick around. And, it's actually things like Judge Dredd, the comic series, actually got that right because, you know, in Judge Dredd's future, the buildings in his megacity, there were still lots of things left over from the 20th century. And then when Blade Runner came out, one of the things they got really got right in Blade Runner was the idea that although it's 2019 and there's flying cars, there's still going to be lots of old, clapped-out cars around, as indeed there are in the real world. And I wanted to get a little bit more of that into Blue Remembered Earth, and not to feel that every single page had to be full of sort of shiny gotcha technology.
But despite all of that, there are two ways in which this is a book that's about, what it's about is whether it's up to you or up to your readers, I don't know. But there are ways in which this book really does seem to be about transformation, right? And not just in terms of the ultimate arc of the trilogy. But in the one hand, the characters spend a great deal of time or at least a comparatively great deal of time, reflecting upon humanity's culpability and responsibility to its ecosystem, having come out the other side of the great climate and environmental shift, right? Having come out of the species, the crash of species, the rising of the sea levels, all of that kind of stuff. And you do that on a micro level, right, through Jeffrey in his research on elephants, something that was sort of striking to be reading your novel over the last few days with these stories coming out about the big uptick in elephant killings in Africa to supply ivory to Asia. One of the things that if you think about species, if you think about sort of megafauna and megafauna that we can see as having cognition levels that we would feel really bad about things that we're doing to them. Elephants are a pretty good example of that. And also one of the great victims, at least of them and their relatives, of human expansion globally. So you have that at a micro level on a very kind of emotional level. You also have that at the macro, the philosophical level through the debates with the panspermiums and the notion of a green efflorescence. Am I getting the terminology right?
Yes.
So that humanity has a responsibility to extend life and in fact, all Earth life into space, almost in a sense as a kind of compensation for what we've done to it. So you have that kind of element that people are thinking through in broad ways, the philosophical implications of humanity's transformation of its environment, both in terms of our responsibility to other species and to the Blue Remembered Earth itself, but also in terms of humanity's own transformation, its own adaptation to the changed ecosystem or to the ecosystem through primarily the water-faring civilization society that maybe you can tell us a little bit about. So it's very much about that. Okay, well, let's go with that. So,
well, I... As I said, when I started writing Blue Remembered Earth, I wanted to, I suppose, go off in a slightly different direction to some of the previous books. And I suppose one of the things I wanted to do was begin to articulate some of those ideas. And perhaps, in a way, when I'm articulating them on the page and I'm thinking about things like species-level responsibility, I'm actually thinking these things through for myself for the first time. It's a way of sort of arguing with myself and trying to see how I feel about them and what side of the argument I come down on. And there'd never really been the sort of scope for that in any of the previous books. I mean, you know, wildlife I don't think gets a mention in Revelation Space, but I'm really sort of deeply interested in wildlife. I'm very into observation of nature on a sort of local level where I live. I'm a passionate bird watcher. I love sort of seeing the sort of the web of living organisms as they interact in my area, and I love studying things and I love learning little tidbits about nature. And I'm very upset by our treatment of animals historically. So as soon as elephants were in the mix, I knew that stuff was going to kind of come out there in the book. And it also, I mean, I always find that if you can set up opposing grand themes in a narrative, that's a good way to sort of lay the seed for some useful conflict later in the storyline. And the idea that Jeffrey, he's studying the elephants, but he's a pragmatist, he's a scientist, he's not really interested in these deeper philosophical questions about guilt and whether we should protect the elephants by moving them off the planet. He's not interested in that. He just wants to get some papers out on and get the next research grant going. But my wife had been, she'd spent a few weeks working at an elephant rehabilitation center in, I think, in Thailand. And she'd come back with lots of photographs and stories about elephants. And that had all sort of soaked in on quite a deep level, I think, over the years with me. And we'd always sort of watched TV documentaries about elephant populations and then always enjoyed looking at elephants in sort of safari parks and zoos and things. And it all seemed a natural fit for the novel at the time. And I'm kind of glad it's all in there because these themes then sort of organically then became more and more important, and themes that I really were glad that were there, that I could then develop for the second novel. But I think as a writer, I'm not. I mean, I think you can probably tell where my sympathies lie in terms of, you know, I think it's a bad idea to kill elephants. There's a controversial statement, you know. But I'm not required as a writer to say whether the panspermian initiative, this is something that I allude to in this book. It's this kind of cult-like organization who almost want to export life into the universe, and they almost don't care if humanity goes along or not. They sort of feel this huge sense of pressing moral obligation to colonize the galaxy with living organisms. And I'm not sure if that's a good idea or not. And I was thinking about, you know, issues like the question of whether we should terraform Mars or not. Do we have a right to introduce native organisms to another planet, or should we leave things as they are? And as a writer, I'm far more interested in sort of balancing those arguments, looking at them from both sides and coming down on one side of the coin or the other. And so for me, it's all, you know, a large part of writing a book like Blue Remembered Earth is just sort of thinking through these things for myself and seeing how I evaluate the arguments.
Well, the other side of that, which is, and I think it's one of the things that makes Blue Remembered Earth so interesting at the level of ideas, is the fact that you do throw these arguments out there. And I agree, it's sometimes seems that we know where your sympathies lie, but, you know, it gets us thinking about them. And you have, in fact, you present multiple sides of the philosophical argument. The other side of that, though, which is closely connected with what we've just been talking about, is this idea that you articulate explicitly in the book, which is that the end point of rapid climate change is potentially a moment of evolutionary change, both at the not only at the biological level, but also at the technological and cultural level, comparable to the formation of the first cities, right? And the formation of human civilization as we know it. And I thought that was really interesting. So this isn't, you know, in a sense you say, well, this is normal for them. But on the other hand, you make it very clear in the novel that one way of thinking about the tremendous change in carrying capacity and the sort of structure of the Earth is a moment of tremendous possibility and uncertainty about the future of humanity. So I was hoping maybe you might elaborate a little bit on that idea and the particular role that evolution and ideas about evolution, both at the biological and the cultural level, play in Blue Remembered Earth.
Well, there's a statement in the book where the character Eunice is pontificating, and she's basically just talking aloud while I think it's Jeffrey is just trying to ignore her. And they're looking down on Africa because they're coming down the space elevator, and she sort of goes off on this elaborate spiel about these sort of forcing events in human history, and you're right, she sort of articulates an argument that there was a great aridification, this 5.9 kilo-year event, which is supposedly a real historical event that's been sort of studied by, I suppose, paleontologists or ethnologists. And the idea is that this was, until this event happened, we hadn't really needed to glom together and form cities. But it forced us to abandon earlier ways of living, and we developed cities. And, of course, with cities, you then get state-level organizations, you get bureaucracy. And you know, you can almost say, well, it's just a short hop and a skip then to technology and space travel. So I'm always looking for those moments in science fiction where you can give the reader a violent lurch of perspective. And the idea that Eunice would posit the idea that really there's no significant change between... you know, humanity gets forced into building cities, and then an eye-blink later we're on the moon. And then there's another one of these forcing events now, which is this global climate change, which forces us to find new ways of coexisting, new ways of living together, new ways of utilizing energy. Well, I don't necessarily buy that as an idea, but it seemed an interesting position for her to adopt, and it also gave me that opportunity to give the reader the sort of lurch of perspective, the idea that, in her view, 8,000 years or however it is nothing. It's just a blip in the sort of continuum. So I'm always sort of, I keep my eyes peeled for sort of moments like that where I can give the sort of reader give them the opportunity to sort of step back and see things anew. And do I believe that climate change would force on us a new mode of living? I don't know. I mean, it depends on how smartly we handle it. I mean, if we could sort of muddle through and then carry on as we were with all the sort of imperfections in society, perhaps that's the best, rather than some sort of wrenching transition to a new social model. But as a science fiction writer, I don't really have to, I don't have to come down strongly on one side or the other. I can just play with these ideas in a very sort of neutral fashion. And for me, much of the most interesting science fiction is written from that position of neutrality, where the writer is sort of just sort of balancing these huge ideas almost like sort of spinning plates and seeing which one falls first.
Well, I do think that one thing that's, I've already alluded to this, that I found extremely compelling about Blue Remembered Earth is not simply that position of neutrality that you just articulated to us, but also I think... a lot of people, are very good at setting in motion a set of changes or contingencies or future imaginaries where we get a very elaborate sense of world building, right? So and this is a very elaborately built world, right? It's a great thought experiment in what things might look like in a few centuries hence. But then the understandings of the ideological modes in which the characters understand that world don't seem to have changed at all, right? They're simply kind of very,
yes,
very crude, or crude is the wrong word because they could be quite sophisticated, but they're fairly straightforward projections from the contemporary period, or they are essentially rehashes with a little bit of cognitive estrangement thrown in, but rehashes,
yes,
of contemporary ideological debates. And I felt that was not going on here, that you had thought very seriously about the cultural and ideological effects on people of the world that you had created. And perhaps it is that sense that for the characters, this is a highly naturalized world. It is not a strange world at all to them. And so the way that they would parse it would have to be natural and objective, natural for them. It would have to be cognitively... I'm now going to repeat myself.
I know exactly what you mean. I mean, to go back to this issue of world building, which is very contentious, I don't sit and build a world. I write a novel, and the sort of implied world, if you like, just develops organically as I write it. And I'm constantly tweaking things, I'm constantly putting things into the mix and take them out, and then if I'll introduce something, it'll have a knock-on effect. It'll sort of ripples of it will spread through the story. Then I go back and sort of try and adjust the characters accordingly. But I don't sit out and sort of sort of mechanistic intentions of creating a world from the outset. It never works like that for me. It's just not the way I operate. And I suppose one thing I try and avoid, one thing I do consciously try and do is make sure that the characters are fully embedded in the imagined world. So they see things, they are living in this world. To them, the most miraculous technologies are a commonplace bread and butter part of their discourse. So they're not impressed by them, and they don't sort of stop every 5 minutes and talk about how this technology works. I think science fiction that does that, it's one of the surest ways to making things feel artificial and stilted. So I was trying, as far as possible, I try and, as you say, give the characters just enough cognitive estrangement for it to feel as if they really are part of this imagined landscape. But the reader also has to be able to navigate their way through the story. So if you have something, I mean, many of the characters in Blue Remembered Earth are completely comfortable with the idea that they can sort of project their own bodies out, you know, they can project their personalities out of their bodies into another recipient, another receptacle, be it another human being or a robot. And I'd been sort of thinking about this for a long time in terms of the mechanics of how you might actually do this using sort of very sophisticated telepresence technology. And it seemed to me that it would almost be inevitable that something like that would come along in 150 years. But to the characters, it would be completely boring and simply a means to an end, a means of having a conversation with someone. So they wouldn't dwell on it. But the reader has to understand the mechanics of this system. They have to understand the implicit limitations. So there's a challenge there for the writer, how the writer gets across to the reader the fact that this technology isn't magic, it does have limitations, it works according to rules, but the characters are not going to dwell on it. And for me, it's a challenge, but it's also, I suppose, when I get it right, or when I think I'm in the process of getting it right, it's one of the bits of science fiction I most enjoy. And it can be really off-putting for the uninitiated. They start reading a science fiction novel like Blue Remembered Earth, and there'll be a sort of throwaway reference on page 3 to some, you know, the characters will say, "I chinged," or something. And what does this mean? And I think the sort of, there are two readers, I think. One reader confronted with such a thing will just give up and say, I can't read this. It's full of made up words that are not defined in context. The other reader will say, "Well, it's science fiction. I know how it works. If I persevere, things will become clear before very long." And you know, because I've been reading science fiction since I was a kid, that to me is just a natural mode of reading, that you just take things on trust hopefully not for chapters on end, but things will sort of settle into place. And that's part of the challenge of the world building, if you like, is that you have to sort of drip feed these sort of things into the plot. You don't want to ram them all into the first chapter. I mean, I deliberately, the way the novel begins, after the sort of brief preliminaries, we're at a funeral, and I wanted it to be a recognizable human gathering. I didn't want it to be lots of people doing something incomprehensible on the moon in sort of four dimensions. So I thought, well, you know, what if these people are just gathering at the family home on Earth? They're not out in space or something, and they're not doing anything weird. They're just gathering to sort of dispose of some ashes. And it seemed to me that was a good way to anchor the reader early in the story and say, look, trust me, these aren't weird characters from the ninth dimension. They're just human beings. They're part of a family with all sort of internal politics of a large family. It's sort of hopefully implicit in that scene. And I hope that there's enough there for the reader to sort of take things on trust then and just accept that, if something weird does intrude into the story, then all will become clear before very long.
Well, as you say, it's a very familiar trope. I mean, it's one of the defining tropes of science fiction, and yet one of the things I liked about your neologisms is that all of them make etymological sense, right? So, you know, voking, for example, clearly a derivation of evoking, and what are you doing? You're evoking something by producing a particular image, shared image, or individual image in augmented reality.
So, I was looking at, mm-hmm. I was trying to work out this, and is it evoking or was it sub-vocalization? Because it's sort of 3 years since I wrote it.
Okay.
I probably couldn't prove it one way or the other. But yes, I do try and not. I mean, there's always a sort of implicit logic to these things, which hopefully makes them easier for the reader to swallow, I think.
Mm. Or maybe we can go off in our own incorrect assumptions about their etymology and they still make sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the author is dead.
I was very disappointed, though, to learn that even in this world of much more advanced wireless communications, augmented reality, biological and nanoengineering, that people still care about journal impact and article impact factor. That was very disturbing to me.
Yes. I wrote that, and I think it was, within a few weeks I was reading about this. There's a whole bunch of agitated academics out there who are sort of trying to move to a new model of scientific publishing, aren't there? A sort of open source model that gets away from the sort of tired old peer review system. So it's probably a bit of a stretch to imagine that 150 years in the future people still submit papers to Nature the way I used to. But it enabled me to position Jeffrey as a if he's doing the same sort of stuff I used to do as a scientist, I can believe in him. If he has to read papers that he's a bit bored by and do peer review and sort out articles that he's not that interested in, then that all sort of feels very familiar, and I can sort of believe in him as a character.
And that is the sort of wonderful mixing of not only the old and the new, but the very mundane with the very wondrous that I think is a common thread in this particular novel. Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving
great us pleasure.
A great deal to think about and a great deal of background about yourself and your ideas and your work.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words on the book. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate the sort of level of analysis you've brought to it. It's really sort of it's not something I take lightly, and I do appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and I hope that we can talk again sometime soon.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Alistair Reynolds discuss his latest book, Blue Remembered Earth, on the New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy podcast. This episode was recorded Thursday, September 6, 2012. So long.